You are listening to an entertainment program put together by a company called Financial Ineptitude. Anything said on this show is not an endorsement or professional advice. Would you really want to tell a court of law you were suing us because you thought taking financial advice from two idiots on a podcast put out by Financial Ineptitude was a good idea? Really? Clown hat, smiley face.
Financial Ineptitude presents Two Bulls in a China Shop. You can find our podcast at twobullsinachinashop.com or just search Two Bulls in a China Shop wherever you stream your podcasts. All right. Hello and welcome, everyone. Come one, come all. Step inside the China Shop. We're opening up today. I'm Shopkeeper Dan. With me, as always, is Kyle, creator of financialineptitude.com. How are you doing today, Kyle?
I'm doing good. Doing good. How about yourself? You feeling better?
I am. I'm feeling physically better. Yes. Yes.
No longer. Was it your third bout with COVID?
No. Well, maybe it was. I don't know. I am pleased to welcome to the shop today, Jonathan Baird from the Global Investment Letter. How are you doing today, Jonathan?
I'm fine, and I'm very happy to be with you today.
All right. Jonathan, also over the past 25-year career as a money manager, he managed three different number one ranked funds. I'm looking at my notes here.
Yeah.
And you won a Lipper Award. That's pretty impressive.
Well, you know, I guess if you stay around long enough.
So which funds did you run?
Back in the 90s, I was with a mutual fund company called Dynamic Funds, and I ran what was called the Dynamic Growth Fund, and then I also managed another Dynamic Fund that was more focused on Canada. And the Dynamic Growth Fund was basically a go anywhere type of mutual fund. And I had a good deal of success with that. Over the 5 years that I ran it, it was essentially the number one fund over that period.
Wow!
And then more recently, I was with a partner in a startup mutual fund company back 10, 15 years ago. And I won the Lipper Award for the Next Gen Global Equity Fund, which was basically, as the name suggests, just a global equity fund. And that was the number one fund in Canada in 2010. Hmm. And then way back in the 80s, when I was just getting started, I had a small cap fund that ended up being, I think, number one way back in 1989. So. And I had just been managing money. I had just been managing money for a couple of years at that point.
So it sounds like you don't even like stick with any one like sector or segment. It sounds like you kind of do it all: small cap, large cap, growth.
That's absolutely true. I made a conscious effort right from the beginning when I got interested in investing to be a generalist, and I would recommend that for anybody that has the interest or has the time to develop that skill, because I think the broader your investment landscape, the more perspective it gives you, the more context it provides. And also, I think just as a function of looking at a wider canvas, so to speak, you're going to be open to more opportunities. So I think there's a lot of reasons why it's important not to get pigeonholed or too micro-focused if you can avoid it.
So the more you learn, the better off you'll be rather than trying to focus on one thing and get good?
Well, I think you can do both things. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the key things is learning as much as you can and developing a skill set of evaluating investments. And those principles or those skills can then be applied to to whatever kind of market that you're looking at. That's certainly sort of what seemed to be the case for me as I developed as an investor over the years.
So did you go to school for any of this, or did you just kind of have to learn it all on your own?
No, I went to business school, and then I got a CFA designation. But yet, so I learned sort of principles of accounting and finance, in business school. But then, you know, in terms of learning about being an investor, experience is an essential element. So basically, I started my career as an analyst with an insurance company, mm-hmm. which is kind of a typical starting point. And then after a couple of years, I got shipped off to the London office to look at European stocks for a little while. And then when I came back, they gave me a small amount of money to run in a small cap fund. Mm-hmm. And I started actually managing money professionally probably 6 months before the 1987 crash.
Ooh.
So I've got a clear memory of that day in my mind. So, Yeah, but I will say that even though I went to business school and the CFA and so on, and you know, that was an important component, there's no replacement also for just reading a lot and absorbing as much about investing in the world as you can, because you'd be surprised at what little bit of knowledge that you put in the back of your head may turn out to be very useful months or even years later.
Yeah, I could definitely attest to that. One of the things that's always surprised us, I think, as we kind of started this podcast and this journey, is just how many people have different styles and that they work. So there's many different things that work. It's just about finding something that works for you is what it seems like.
I think that's very true. And I think in my case, my style has evolved over the years fairly considerably. When I first started out, I was a diehard value investor,
mm-hmm.
and you couldn't get more value focused than I was when I was, you know, in my 20s. But then as I moved along in my career and started managing more money,
mm-hmm.
And got exposed to more markets and so on, my approach started to branch out. And I started to incorporate more macro considerations in my investing.
Mm-hmm.
And as time went on, even though I kept the value principles, because I think they're legitimate, at the same time, I also recognized that the main drivers of markets tend to be things like investor sentiment, the interest rate environment, geopolitics, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I write about in the Global Investment Letter, as well as writing about my own positions in the markets and why I have them and so on.
Speaking of the Global Investment Letter, how did you kind of come about to that? I mean, it sounds like you had a pretty good career managing, you know, funds.
Yeah.
Did you just get tired of it one day or what?
Well, you know, what happened was that the last stop before the Global Investment Letter that I was at, as I mentioned, I was a partner in a startup mutual fund company, mm-hmm. and we ended up getting bought out by a French merchant bank.
So then I had to decide
sort of what to do. And you know, I decided going to manage my own money. There's less hassle that way. But also, I thought that there would be a need and a value for something like the Global Investment Letter. And I got that idea from a number of posts that I put up that I wrote on LinkedIn.
Really? LinkedIn?
And the feedback from LinkedIn was very gratifying and surprising to me at the time. And people were messaging me and so on, asking if, you know, there was a larger publication that I was writing, or whether there was a paid version of my comments. And there wasn't at that time, but that gave me the idea for the Global Investment Letter. And then that became the Global Investment Letter. And now I'm happy and surprised to say that, you know, I've got their subscribers all over the world. Literally, I think five of the seven continents are subscribers.
You must have had one hell of a post that you put up on LinkedIn then, because a lot of the things I see on there don't make me wonder if this guy has more to say.
Well, it was a series of posts, yeah. And you know, it was probably 10 or 12. And, you know, I was talking about the markets, you know, based on my own experience managing money and so on. And I would try and put up what I thought was an interesting graphic and so on. Mm-hmm. And that tended to resonate with people. And I still put up the odd post on LinkedIn now just to share, you know, to share my thoughts with people. And there's certainly no shortage of things to be talking about these days.
Right. What's your take on the Ukraine situation?
Apparently, well, as of this afternoon, apparently Macron, the president of France, says he's had some kind of a diplomatic breakthrough with Putin. Hmm. I've got sort of mental images of Neville Chamberlain coming back from talking with Hitler.
Right.
So I don't know if anything's going to come of that. I think that there's, assuming that the Macron thing, you know, isn't going to work or didn't happen, I think there's a reasonable chance that Russia will move in on the Ukraine. I think that probably it'll happen either late February or early March.
Wow.
Because I think that Putin doesn't want to get in the way of China's Olympics, considering that China and Russia are quite tight these days. So he doesn't want to steal the spotlight from that. And then if he waits too long and the ground starts to thaw in the in the Ukraine, it makes moving tanks a bit more challenging.
Yeah, it just turns to mud, right?
So I think if it's going to happen, it'll be sort of late February, early March. You know, let's hope for the best. But
well, all Ukraine has to do is not join NATO, and I think tensions ease. Isn't that like kind of the main?
Well, yeah, and the thing is, they're not members of NATO, and I don't think NATO had any plans on having them join. But at the same time, you can't have a third party telling you who you can or cannot invite into your organization.
Right.
So, so his demand, there was no way the West could have just capitulated to his demands because they wouldn't stop there.
I get the feeling when I think of Putin, it makes me think of, you ever see the movie Canadian Bacon?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, the president of the United States is played by Alan Alda, and his ratings are in the tank. So this is after the Cold War has ended. So he brings the Russian president back. He's trying to get the old, you know, Cold War thing going again so he can drum up his supporters.
Yeah.
I get the feeling that like Putin is like itching for the glory days of the Cold War.
Well, you know, he actually said that the biggest geopolitical setback of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So he probably does miss the old days.
I would assume he would say that. That's kind of a big deal for him.
Well, it was, and you know, he was in the KGB in those days and everything. So you know.
So what else do you talk about in the investment letter?
Well, you know, I offer my comments on the major equity and currency, commodity and bond markets. So, you know, I'll talk about in the February issue just got published late last Thursday on the 3rd. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some topics that I was talking about in that issue was inflation, prospects for interest rate increases. I did touch on the Ukraine issue. And you know, investor sentiment is an important factor to be aware of on an ongoing basis, because ultimately, you know, I think that it may be the number one driver of markets is just investor sentiment. Because that does explain why we have the, you know, runaway bull markets and market crashes that seem to to go to levels that don't make any sense.
How do you track the investor sentiment?
There's a variety of different things that I've picked up, you know, over the years. You can look at the volatility index, the VIX, which is a useful measure of investor sentiment as volatility rises. That tends to correlate strongly with rising investor concerns.
Right.
There's anecdotal evidence. You even look at things like magazine covers. I know that sounds funny, but it's true. Back late last year, there were a couple of covers that were talking about the Roaring Twenties. That basically the 2020s were going to be like the 1920s, and you know the markets are going to be a party for the next 9 or 10 years, and so on. So I just take note of that kind of overt bullishness and so on. And when the bullishness or bearishness gets too extreme, then I start looking for indications that I should start going the other way.
Right. You know? I was going to say, if the majority was right, nobody would lose money in the crashes.
Well, that's right. So you're looking for, you know, in my case, you know, I'm looking for market extremes or economic extremes. Just extremes of any sort, and taking note of them, and then I'm watching to see if I can match that sort of contrary view with a definite sort of sell or buy signal, and that's part of the methodology that I've developed over the years. Which, you know, I sort of think of it as trying to be as pragmatic as possible. And, you know, on balance, it's worked over the years. So. Mm-hmm.
Dan, do you have any questions?
Really, really interested in geopolitical events and how it can affect markets. What are some setups kind of stuff that goes into your newsletter? Like, is it just like going through the news, or do you have prescriptions like now it's a good time to get into defense stocks because Ukraine looks like they're about to go to war?
Yeah, I mean, I will. In fact, the defense sector has been a long-term theme in the global investment letter. It doesn't mean I always own the defense stocks, because I'm also looking at the market price action of the sector. And so I'll stay in the defense sector, let's say, as long as I think the defense sector is acting well. For example, I did very well in the defense sector up until I sold in March 2020. I got quite concerned about COVID fairly early on, and I started following it. And in the March 5th issue of the Global Investment Letter, I said that this is going to be a major economic issue, and I recommend that people sell their sell equities and go into U.S. Treasuries. And so, when I sold my holdings in defense at that point, I have yet to actually repurchase them. Because the price action of the sector just didn't seem to warrant it. If we see some sustained military conflict in Europe, that might change, because the defense sector is improving in terms of relative strength versus the S&P 500. And certainly a consideration of geopolitics will be a factor in making a decision about defense stocks and so on. That is a consideration. I think that the situation in Ukraine is a major component to the current strength that we're seeing in the price of oil, because Russia controls about 40% of the energy requirements of Western Europe yep. through pipelines and so on. So these concerns about Russia's actions and the potential for Russia to reduce or even cut off the pipelines to Europe, in the middle of the winter, is having an effect on oil prices and so on. So geopolitics can have a fairly sharp effect. They're typically not terribly long lasting, but they can be very dramatic.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about price action, but now you talked about oil, so now I want to ask you about that. yeah. Oil's been steadily marching up to $100 a barrel after, I think it was sometime last year, Russia was predicting that. And with Russia controlling so much of the supply, if they think it's going to happen, then they have the power to, push it towards that. Do you see the rise in oil prices continuing, or is that something that you think will abate at some point here soon?
I think it probably will abate if the geopolitical situation calms down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also the fact that we're probably going to see interest rate increases is probably going to impact the global economy, which is already, to my mind, demonstrating signs of weakness. I mean, the Chinese economy is definitely slowing. Germany is in a recession. I think Japan, if I'm not mistaken, the last quarterly GDP number I saw was actually negative.
Oh.
So the global economy is already slowing. And if that is coupled with rising interest rates, then a further slowing of the global economy should presumably affect demand, which should then therefore result in lower oil prices. But if geopolitical issues remain elevated, whether it's in the Ukraine or there's some issue in the Middle East with Iran or something, mm-hmm. then we could see continued high oil prices. Oil is the commodity that over historically has been the most susceptible to geopolitical shocks.
Mm-hmm. That kind of makes sense too, considering how many major producers they are in the locations that they're in.
Well, most of the major producers, are in relatively unstable parts of the world.
Right.
Yeah.
Venezuela, the Middle East.
Exactly. Even Africa, Nigeria yep. and so on. So.
Let's see. Okay. So now you mentioned price action a minute ago. Does that mean that you, when you say price action, are you talking about like technical analysis or are you looking at something else?
Well, sort of. It used to be called, I guess in the old days, it would have been called the tape, but the tape's not really around anymore because everything's electronic. But basically, it's how the markets, the markets behave. And I guess, there is a component to technical analysis in that as well. And so typically what I do is, I have a view of the world and then I watch to see if the market ends up confirming my view of the world or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think a good example of this is I've been very concerned about the global economy and the potential catalysts for volatility in equity markets for a while, like mm-hmm. probably, over a year. But I did not sell my long positions last year, despite my bullish view, my bearish view of the macros, because the price action of the markets in 2021 did not, to my mind, signal a sell indication. So that actually allowed me, and I wrote it probably a couple of times in the Global Investment Letter last year. I said, there's never been a year where I've been so basically bearish when I've made so much money on the long side. And so I waited. Now that started the change late last year and in January.
Mm-hmm.
I started to reduce some of my or eliminate some of my long positions One of the things that I'm an advocate of is using protective sell prices or sell stops, mm-hmm. and as a way to control risk. But at the same time, it where you put those sell stops or sell prices is important too. And yep. there is an element of technical analysis, and plus my experience as a money manager, that that guides me in terms of where to put them. And that's one of the things I talk about in the Global Investment Letter is I share with people, what my market positions are. And I'll also talk about, I've got a sell price here. And, if the market gets down to this level, I'm out. Mm-hmm. But as I say, there's a bit of an art to that because, you don't want to be whipsawed all the time. You have to let markets have a bit of room to move. But at the same time, you don't want to linger when there's been a change of trend. And right. so setting those sell price levels and so on is, my experience over the years has helped me sort of develop a feel for that. Doesn't mean, of course, that I'm right or I'm perfect all the time, but the experience does pay off.
Well, yeah, this is a game of odds, right?
You know what? I'm glad you said that because that's exactly true. Mm-hmm. Is that, and I think that a lot of investors sometimes forget that. Mm-hmm. It is a game of odds. You're dealing in probabilities, not certainties. And so you can't expect to be perfect. What you try and do is just get your batting average, so to speak, as high as you can, and make sure that when you win more than you lose when you lose.
Right.
And so probability is a big factor in the way I look at markets. I try and attach probabilities to different outcomes and so on as a way to sort of guide my decision making. And that's a very good point you made.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. That might not be a bad idea whenever you're looking at trade ideas to assign a confidence metric to it.
Yeah. Everything gets a bit easier with experience. But I can tell you, the markets that we've had for the last couple of years are certainly not been easy for me. But I've enjoyed the challenge in trying to figure them out.
All you got to do is buy and hold for the last year. I think that's changing now, though.
Yeah, until that doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly.
You can talk to somebody that's long Facebook.
Peloton.
Yeah. Trying to think in terms of probabilities is a very good idea. And I certainly do that.
Oh, you mentioned interest rate hikes a minute ago. I've been seeing anywhere from like 4 to, I think B of A is predicting 7. I think they're the highest. What are your thoughts on that as far as how many hikes we're going to get this year?
I have a hard time seeing 5 or 6 or 7 interest rate hikes.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is I think that, as I mentioned earlier, I think global economy is pretty fragile as it is without interest rate hikes. Right. And I think the effect of the first or second interest rate hike may be dramatic enough that it may scare central banks from raising rates much further.
Mm. You don't think it's already priced in?
Well, I mean, the consensus is more and more. I think what it is that if you raise rates a couple of times, or even 3 times, whatever it takes, and you start seeing evidence of a recession,
mm-hmm.
The central bank is unlikely to continue to raise rates into a recession.
Right.
I also think that the current inflation that we're seeing is different than what's been experienced previously in the United States and Canada. It's a supply-driven inflation rather than a demand-driven inflation that we had, let's say, back in the 1970s. And so if I'm right in that, I don't know if interest rates will be as effective in combating that as they were back in the days when Paul Volcker raised rates to 20% to crush demand. I think that what we're likely to see is inflation starting to ease again when the effects of COVID on supply chains and so on start to diminish. And one of the reasons why the supply chains have had such an impact on inflation is because over the last, probably 30 years, 35 years, the world has moved to just-in-time inventory management.
Right.
Where basically they're keeping inventory levels very low, so they don't have to tie up capital in inventory and are relying on quick replenishment, which is where the supply chain comes in. So the supply chain disruption would not have had the effect on inflation if it had occurred in the 1960s as it does now.
Right.
So I think a lot rests on the world getting back to a semblance of normal, you know, with regards to the pandemic and starting to see the pressures on supply movement easing. And I think that'll be the biggest reason why you'll start seeing inflationary pressures ease. I think central banks are kind of trapped in that I don't know if they've got the ability to raise rates to what used to be historically normal levels without creating an enormous global recession, because the world as a whole is just so indebted.
Mm-hmm.
And so the negative leverage that's in place on even a small increase in interest rates is significant. Hmm. So I'm prepared to change my mind if the facts change. But right now, I have a hard time seeing how the Fed or the Bank of England or any central bank can get away with raising rates 5 or 6 times. But like I say, I'll change my mind when the facts change, but that's sort of my current thinking.
You mentioned the supply chain being the major cause of the inflation this go around. I mean, we printed a lot of money in 2020. You don't think that the inflation's tied to any of that?
You know what? I don't.
Why is that?
We printed a lot of money in 2008 as well, mm-hmm. and people were expecting inflation back then, and it didn't materialize.
Hmm.
Well, one of the things is that inflation, there's an important psychological component to inflation. I don't subscribe that it's a largely monetary issue, or else we would have had significant inflation before now.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a psychological component to inflation where, as in the 1970s, people started to get the idea that if they deferred spending, they would end up paying more for something in 6 months or a year. So they started to bring forward their purchases, whatever it was, a TV, a car, clothes, whatever. And that created incremental demand, which in turn drove the inflationary processes. I included a chart in the issue of the Global Investment Letter that I did last week that looked at how worried people were about inflationary pressures over the last, 60 or 70 years. And back in the late 70s, early 80s, 52% of people in the United States were saying inflation was the number one issue facing the U.S. economy. At the end of 2021, it was 8% of people.
What? Sorry, did you say 8 or 80?
8.
8.
8. 8.
Really?
Less than 10%.
I guess there's other things they're worried about.
Well, that's right. And so until that number starts going up into the 30s, 40s, you're not going to see people, reconsider, you know, moving up their purchases and artificially stimulating the economy as a result of the, and in turn producing inflationary pressures. So
it's interesting that you make that connection, because then that makes it sound like the large inflation in the 70s was also supply chain related. If it was psychological and people bringing up their purchases and they're buying.
It wasn't supply chain. What kicked it off was the decision by Saudi Arabia and OPEC to basically triple or quadruple the price of oil. And that oil price shock, because oil, right, oil is a component. Well, it was even more a component in everything back then than it is now. But basically, that price increase overnight made the price of almost everything higher.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, that oil price shock had obviously a psychological effect on people, and that in turn started to produce the when I look back on the major inflationary episodes, you know, in history,
mm-hmm,
most of them are not, or almost all of them are not sort of purely a function of monetary issues. It tends to be a loss of confidence in government, or a psychological expectation of inflation. Or, you know, in the case of the 70s, you had this this sudden price shock. Mm-hmm. You know, like there was an huge inflation back, you know, in the last decade in Zimbabwe.
Oh, yep.
And it was like, you know, it was like the inflation that we saw in Germany in the 20s, where, you know, you needed a wheelbarrow to carry your money around.
I was actually looking at $1 trillion Zimbabwean bills just to buy one, to have one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was there was a complete collapse in the confidence of the government and institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so people didn't want to hold, you know, the Zimbabwe currency. They wanted to trade it for dollars or euros or what have you. You know, and in Germany in the 20s, which is another famous inflationary episode,
mm-hmm,
that largely was a result of post-World War I effects on German morale and the German economy and the political crises that allowed Adolf Hitler to ultimately gained power in the 1930s.
Yep.
So that was a, you know, so, you know, I mean, I pay attention to monetary policy and so on, but I, you know, I don't subscribe to the notion that that's necessarily going to be the driver of inflation. You know, if that was the case, you know, we'd have gold at, like, I don't know, $10,000 an ounce, and you know, gold. You know, there are the gold bugs will say is the ultimate inflation hedge. Well, you know, I'm not going to argue about that, because it hasn't been for the last 40 years. But even if you still believe that, the fact that gold is not moving, yep, is telling you, if you're a gold bug, that this inflation is going to be temporary, because it's not moving.
Yeah, Bitcoin, I mean,
it's moving
either
a little bit, but it's not moving the way you would expect given the monetary growth, right?
Right.
So it's a wacky world we live in investment-wise these days.
Speaking of it, Dan, I'm sure you want to ask some turkey-related questions now that we just talked about currencies.
Yes. Are you familiar with, I mean, of course you are. We've been following Turkey and their currency fall and what Erdogan's doing to prop it up. Do you have any insight onto that you could share with us?
Yeah, I am familiar. You know, I follow what's going on in Turkey, because it's an important country, sort of given its location and so on. I'll just make one passing comment that the Turkey situation with Erdogan is a perfect example of what I'm talking about in terms of the effects of loss of confidence in governments and institutions and so on. Mm-hmm. Somebody in his position, you know, I mean, you can try doing things like manipulating interest rates and so on. I think what might happen is, and historically what has happened in cases that we've seen in Turkey, is that at some point the government will issue a new currency and make the old currency convertible into the new currency at some fixed amount, and then hope for the best.
Just basically start from scratch.
Well, that's been done before.
Yeah,
and that's what happened in Germany. You had the Notgeld, and then they eventually sort of, you know, basically recapitalized the currency or issued a new currency, and so on. And this has happened, you know, through history. So that is an option that he could take. Hmm. It is difficult though when you're dealing with matters of psychology or investor confidence. It's difficult once you lose it. It's difficult to get back,
right?
Without having to resort to fairly extreme measures. Yep. And the new currency may be one of those things. Charles de Gaulle did that during a currency crisis in France in the late 1950s. It's done, you know, not all the time, but it's done regularly through history.
Make a good point too about the loss of confidence. Trust is a hard thing to earn.
You know, it really is in all aspects of life.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't add any fuel to my beef with Turkey.
Well, I mean, if they print a new currency, then we'll be able to say, ah,
caught you trying to save your currency.
There was some talk about him possibly. I mean, there's some speculation about Turkey looking at Bitcoin as a replacement, I think, because he was meeting with the president of El Salvador. Anything ever happen to that?
No, I don't. I think that was just as a dirty rumor, you know.
Oh, okay. So,
I don't think that would happen. I don't think Bitcoin is a sort of a solution for a national currency, you know.
No, the IMF agrees with you.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the big danger for people that do hold Bitcoin is that the various central banks will just create their own digital currency.
Yeah.
And that'll be backed by the government or the central bank or whatever. And if that catches on in a big way, and it's already happened in China,
yep,
then, you know, the value of Bitcoin becomes a bit problematic.
Might have to censor that bit. I got a lot of crypto fans that don't want to hear that.
Well, you know,
I'm just teasing off. We don't censor anything.
You know what? The thing is, you've always, no matter how bullish or bearish you are on things, it's mm-hmm. always a good idea to think about, okay, what's got to happen for me to change my mind?
Yes.
Like over the holidays, yeah. I was talking to a fellow my daughter is dating, and he just loves Tesla. Tesla is, you know, it's just loves it. and that's fine. I mean, I didn't try and argue with him about it because I've got nothing against Tesla. Mm-hmm. The only thing I would say is that, you know, as I said to him, is that, you know, when you're that bullish about something or bearish, it's always a good idea to try and say, okay, you know, what would it take for me to change my mind on this?
Right.
You know, it's something that I try and practice as well. And you know, I mean, I hope Bitcoin goes to $1 million. I mean, I've got nothing against Bitcoin per se, but at the same time, it wouldn't be a bad idea if you are long Bitcoin to be aware of some of the potential threats.
Or to just, you know, get paid a little bit. You don't have to hold it all.
Take some profit when you got it.
Well, you know.
So what would it take to change you into a bull then if you're still leaning bear these days?
In terms of the equity markets?
Yeah.
I would like to see a nice market decline that's coupled with a real capitulation of investor sentiment.
You mean you want to see a real sell-off, not this just straight upward?
A big sell-off, but I would also like to see an extreme of bearish sentiment as well, and that would make me very bullish. And you know, it's going to happen eventually. I don't know when it's going to happen. It's uncertain when it's going to happen, but it's also inevitable that it's going to happen.
So you want, but you're talking about more than the recent drop from January to February?
Yes. I mean, I'm talking about sort of a bear market. And that would sort of clear the decks in terms of improving valuation. Once again, the idea is too, I would ideally attempt to catch an inflection point in terms of bearishness on the part of investors, and then go the other way when I saw the price action of the market suggest that, you know, the bottom was in. I don't know when that's going to occur. It's going to occur eventually. But you just have to be attentive and watch for developments. I certainly think that this decade, that, you know, the 2020s, are going to be very challenging for investors. It's going to be a very volatile decade because of the various economic and geopolitical catalysts out there for volatility. And we started to see a little bit of that in January.
I'm guessing where the Global Investment Letter can help people.
Well, you know, it's got not a bad track record. I've continued on sort of, you know, where I left off managing money in terms of my investment positions and so on. Mm-hmm. And the results have been very good. I would also say there are sample issues available for people to look at on the website. All you have to do is leave your name and email address, and you'll get access to the sample issues, and you'll also get the free weekly little email that I send out on investing that you can unsubscribe to whenever you want. So for people that are interested, there's a selection of sample issues there.
Awesome. And that's at globalinvestmentletter.com?
That's right.
And we'll have links to that in the episode description.
You ever think about doing a podcast?
Oh, there you go. Yeah, why not?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. People have mentioned that to me. I don't know. I haven't even sort of done a YouTube video yet, so.
Oh, podcasts are easier because you don't have to do the video.
No, that's true.
Oh, yeah, you handled yourself well with us. I think you'd probably be pretty successful if you decided to give that a shot.
Well, thanks very much. I mean, no, it was nice talking to you guys. I mean, you made some good points, you know, like your point about the thinking in terms of probabilities and some of the geopolitical things. I mean, you know, those are, you know, it's a lot easier to have a conversation with people that, you know, that sort of, you know, make good comments and stuff.
So. Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you. Every now and then we get a good one in there.
Yeah. You had several.
Stupid.
You had several. I mean, you know.
Several. Ooh, all right.
Yeah, oh. I know. What I can do is I've got a fairly large following on LinkedIn, and I've got a fairly large email list. So what I will do is, if you want to send me, you know, once you get things edited and stuff, a link to the
podcast, of course,
and stuff, I'll certainly do my best in terms of promoting it and so on.
Oh, excellent. Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Well, actually, let's let Dan wrap this up, and then I'll kind of tell you what we'll do for you.
All right. So, folks, there you have it. The wonderful award-winning Jonathan Baird from globalinvestmentletter.com. Check out their website. Like he said, you can get some sample issues delivered to your email. Jonathan, it's been so great having you here in the shop. We want to thank you sincerely once again for coming by.
It's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Me too.
All right. Any final parting thoughts, Kyle?
I can't follow that up.
All right. Well,
why do you always want my parting thoughts when we talk to an award-winning money manager with 25 years of experience? Do what he does, guys. Do what he does.
Can you top that, Kyle? You got anything better?
No. Just imitate.
All right. All right. We'll be back at you soon, folks. Until then, happy trades.
Bye, folks. Thanks for joining us. You can find us off air at twobullsinachinashop.com. That's the number 2bullsinachinashop.com. Make sure you check us out. Download us on any streaming network. Blah, 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 blah. You know what to do. Rate, subscribe.
Two Bulls in a China Shop is an entertainment program, and all thoughts and opinions expressed in the show belong to the hosts and not of any company. They are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security or investment product. It is only intended to provide entertainment about stocks and the financial industry of trading. If you make trades based on what you hear in this show, you assume all risks for those trades.